Okay. So thanks. So as far as this project is concerned, it's sort of the main interest is to get you used to actually using the code provided and using the crawl provided. Okay, and obviously task zero is nothing, it's just getting to start, and then task one is also almost nothing because they provide most of the code, and then all you need to do is vector space ranking. What's the size of the crawl now? It's 25,000 documents, so which is very small really, but you will see that if you do inefficient computations even on that, you can take time. Okay, so you know, I mean, part of the fun would be actually to you know, crawl yourself. You can start crawling and then get more documents, but you potentially can do that for other parts. This part we provided the same crawl so that it actually also makes it easier for us to check whether things are working or not. Okay. And then I did provide a deadline, which is February, and I should have put it in the earlier up. It's on February 28th. Ooh, that's nice. I didn't know that. And it's sort of an aspirational deadline. I think if people are comfortable with Java, it should not be hard to reach that at all. But on the other hand, if most of the people are having trouble with part A, then you know part B won't make sense because if, you know, all the part B is directly extending part A, okay, using PageRank and various other things. So you know, you get done by 20th February, you'll have more time for part B and C, which will have more interesting things to do. But at the same time, I think from the background sheet that you sent me, people should not have, you know, the majority should not have too much trouble. But if you are having trouble, please get in touch with TA sooner than rather than later. And the other thing that can be done is if there are, I mean, we were wondering whether they should be one of the, whether he should consider holding like a separate session where he goes over the code, etc. for you, but it's not very clear to me that that would be useful. However, he's willing to have extra time. He already has, I think, Wednesday office hours, but if there's more demand, then he can have more office hours. So it's to some extent, the ball is in your court. Okay, so you need to make sure that you get started. Okay, that's as far as the project is concerned, and you're done. Okay, so that's project A discussion, part A discussion. The other one is we had some discussion on the blog with some people. By the way, the idea is that, I mean, I think it's working out fine right now, but I do want to just state the obvious that I'm not looking for everybody answering every topic. But on the other hand, if you find yourself going through the entire, if you find yourself, what have happened to the high density thing, high dimensionality thing? Oh yeah, there it is. Okay. If you find yourself going to the entire semester not having posted any comments on any of the discussion topics, then you aren't paying attention to the discussion aspect of the course. Okay. One of the things here, the things that I wanted you to think about is the issue of high dimensionality of data. Many of your intuitions about vectors, etc., go out the window when you are considering very high dimensions. And you saw two sort of telling examples. One is that high dimensional apples are all peel and no core, which is quite interesting. You know, you think that if you remove a little peel from the apple still exists. And however, you're just showing that, you know, at high dimensions, basically, all you have is the peel. If you remove the peel, you have no apple left. And which is sort of only to tell you that your intuitions lead you astray. That part in itself is not completely directly related to the connection with the vector space similarity matrix, for example. What does have connection is a related one, which is high dimensional vectors are mostly perpendicular to each other. Okay, the fact that high dimensional vectors are mostly perpendicular to each other, that means there's a very high chance that two random high dimensional vectors would be perpendicular. So the probability that a pair of vectors would be perpendicular increases as the dimensionality increases. And it becomes quite high, you know, for the kind of dimensionality that we are talking about. So for example, one of the interesting issues is to realize, as somebody pointed out, that so for example, in 1000 dimensional space, 97% of the, in 1000 dimensional space, then 0.004% of the apple is left after you remove the peel. Okay, now you might say, who the heck cares about 1000 dimensional space? But remember, we started discussion by saying that you can think of documents as vectors in the space of terms. Now the terms are English vocabulary, unless you did keyword detection and you have a librarian who basically said only certain number of words are real words, the other ones are not keywords, and then they count, you know, kept it down to like 3000 or, you know, 300 or something. Even then, actually, you know, even librarians have probably up to thousands of keywords. But English vocabulary as a whole is much, much larger. So 1000 dimensions is really a small number. It's a, you know, gross underestimate as to the dimensionality of the space that you're looking at, really, you know, for full text search. Okay, so this is a very reasonable point to know that, you know, that this is as high as you probably ever thought of. And then in these kinds of high dimensions, the probability that a pair of vectors is, you know, a pair of random vectors is perpendicular to each other is quite high. Okay, again, that's something that you have to keep in mind, because you are making this whole similarity discussion in terms of vector similarities, vector similarity in terms of the cosine theta. And if it's perpendicular, cosine theta will always be close to zero. Okay, so that's sort of an interesting offside thing to keep in mind. Okay, the other thing is, that's just a question, does anybody have an answer to that? Quickly. Cosine theta can be generally negative, so can vector space similarity be negative? It's a very simple question.
No.
Who said no? Yeah, why not? So again, this is something that you have to have in the back of your head. We didn't vocalize it, you know, explicitly, but all our vectors are in the first quadrant. They're in the positive x, positive y axis. I mean, if you think of two-dimensional vectors, because a keyword at most can have zero frequency. It cannot have negative frequency. There is no meaning for negative frequency. Okay. So in for normal vectors, normal term document vectors, cosine theta will always be between 0 and 1. It's not between 0 and minus 1. It's not between minus 1 and plus 1. Even though cosine theta itself can be between minus 1 and plus 1. Okay. Again, you know, it's not that, I think you should try and connect up things to things, you know, things discussed in the class to things that you already know. So that's the only way you can check whether you're understanding things, whether understanding the point or not, because otherwise it will be a body of knowledge which is completely unconnected to anything that you ever learned, and that's pretty useless. You know, everything that you learned has to be connected to everything else that you learned to the extent you can. Okay, so you have to ask yourself this question. So anyway, last time we were talking about the many problems of vector space similarity, and we looked at the various problems that you expect, and then we said we'll do some things to improve vector space ranking. There are many, many things you can do to improve vector space ranking, some of which are really hard to do. For example, you can give up on the idea that vectors, documents are bags of words, and actually start doing some natural language processing. But you don't want to do that. Okay, so you want to do something cheaper than that. So one of the, here are a couple of things that we will look at in this discussion. One is relevance feedback, which we already discussed, and I'll, you know, if there's questions, I'll go over it again. But it essentially tries to improve the query that the user is providing. Okay, so to the extent user query is not particularly indicative of what the user is really looking for, you would have some sort of a indirect interaction with the user. That's what relevance feedback is doing. We saw last time that essentially what you do is you take the new query, if you show the first 10 documents, first K documents, and then you ask user in essence, or you see which ones user considered relevant, which one users considered irrelevant. Okay, and then the new query is essentially the average of the vectors corresponding to the relevant queries, relevant documents, minus the average of the vectors corresponding to the irrelevant documents. Now this is nice because you can just add and subtract. You know, add, you can compute an average vector given a bunch of vectors, which is the centroid of that those set of vectors. And then so you basically take the centroid of the relevant documents and centroid of the irrelevant documents, and you take the difference between them. That would be the best in terms of coming up with a new query. This would be the best with respect to what the user has shown till now. And then you run that query on the corpus again, and then you can show the next 10. Okay, so that's the relevance feedback. We looked at that. The other issue is, the other two are connected to the fact that, in fact, the terms in the document are not really independent dimensions. Okay, because the very fact that you're thinking of documents as vectors in the space of terms sort of implies that you think all the terms are independent of each other. Remember that discussion I was having last time, that if you have a 10,000 dimensional vector, and if I give you 9,999 dimensions of that vector, you still do not know anything about that one last dimension. That's what it means for dimensions to be independent. But that's not true for words in the document. They're actually highly correlated. Sometimes they're negatively correlated, sometimes they're positively correlated, but they're correlated after all. You know, many things are independent, but there are also local pockets of dependencies. For example, computer and science, data and structure. Okay? So the question would be, how do you keep track of the fact that, how do you exploit the fact that keywords are actually connected to each other? And we will look at two ideas, which sort of can be thought of as easy idea, harder idea. Rather shallower idea and deeper idea. And the shallower idea essentially says, let's just look for what are the keywords that are correlated with each other. Okay? And in a sense, by doing this correlation analysis, you provide a functional dictionary of synonyms. So to the extent word computer seems to be appearing all the time with word science, maybe they're sort of related. Now, once you find the correlation, then you can use it in many, many different ways. One obvious idea is as query elaboration tool. So if somebody just gave you computer as the query, you can then show the top K words that are most correlated with computer and ask the user, would you like to pick any of these ones? Okay? And that will allow the user to provide elaboration of the query, which in some sense is related to what relevance feedback is doing too, which is we all know that the users are looking for something and typing something else. Okay, so you want to make up for their laziness by either suggesting them more ways of refining their query, which is what query elaboration means. Okay. Or you can just see what they do and try to get more information about what it is that they're really looking for as against what they typed. Okay, that's what relevance feedback does. And then we will go from here and further and then realize that in fact we can do dimensionality reduction, which in essence is related to the discussion we had towards the end of the class last time, that in fact keywords, once you don't have independent dimensions, one of the possibilities is that the dimensions are linearly dependent on each other. And if they're linearly dependent on each other, the true dimensionality of the data might be much smaller than the total dimensionality of the data. I showed you, starting with how two keywords, K1 and K2, you can make infinite number of extra dimensions, 2K1 plus 3K2, 5K1 minus 7K2, etc., etc. Okay? So the question, of course, is, if you can you then invert this? If I give you that kind of a data, is there a way of going back to the inherent dimensionality of the data? And it turns out that doing that analysis is essentially principal components analysis, and it winds up kind of doing everything that correlation analysis does plus more. Okay, so we'll go in that order. Okay. Are there any further questions on the relevance feedback technique that we discussed last time? Okay. Now, notice that the obvious idea would be that I'm assuming that even though I haven't formally introduced this idea of classification learning, which is basically given a set of examples, which are positive examples of what you're trying to learn and some of which are negative examples of what you're trying to learn, trying to figure out an implicit description for what it is that you're trying to learn, so that when a new example comes, a test example comes, you can correctly classify it. Okay? And in some sense, the entire IR problem, the entire relevance estimation problem, can be seen as a learning problem, a classification learning problem, where you see enough number of, for the query, you see enough number of documents that the user liked, enough number of documents that the user didn't like, and then you pose it as a classification learning problem, and you compute like the best classifier, which seems to distinguish positives from negatives, and then you start applying it for new documents. Okay, so the relevance feedback Rocchio method essentially can be seen as an extreme form of learning, where all the positive examples are being combined. I mean, basically the entire set of positive examples are being represented by their centroid. Entire set of negative examples are being represented by their centroid, and they're taking the centroid difference. Okay, and we'll see that sometimes you could do one of the interesting things that happens here is that since the original query is already a vector in the space of keywords, the new query is also a vector in the space of keywords, and there is a nice natural way of using this new centroid minus centroid query as a new query. It's just a centroid of relevant documents minus centroid of irrelevant documents, and that can still be seen as a new query. Okay, and then you do retrieval, but in essence, what it's doing is again trying to figure out trying to classify unseen documents in terms of their relevance and irrelevance. Okay, so you want to keep in the back of your mind that retrieval and classification are very closely correlated. And we'll get back to, in fact, you can think of this method as a kind of learning method, classification method for text documents. Okay, we'll see more. How many of you have heard at all of classification learning in other classes? Okay, so think of this Rocchio classification learner as similar to decision tree learner or a naive-based classifier or whatever. Okay, so you can ask yourself, why not use those instead of this? I describe this to you right now because it's the easiest. I don't have to explain to you anything else about classification learning. You can add up and subtract vectors. But it may not be the best technique, necessarily. Okay. Now, you also have to differentiate between the general idea of relevance feedback, which essentially only says that based on what the user is finding relevant versus irrelevant, try to reformulate the query, I try to really learn what the user is looking for. And the specific Rocchio approach, is that what I said? Okay. Which is just one specific way of doing relevance feedback. Another might be to do some other classification technique, naive-based classifier or something. Okay? So that's worth keeping in mind. Okay. The next one, as I said, I'm going to start realizing that, in fact, keywords may be correlated with each other and try to find out which keywords seem to be correlated with which other keywords. Okay. Again, the word keyword and the word term would be used synonymously. Okay. because if you're doing full text search, every term is a keyword. Okay, and a document is basically a vector in the space of terms. Okay, so now the question, of course, is, so you're trying to do co-occurrence analysis. How do they occur together more often than not? Okay, so two terms that are related. The one use for this is, if you do find correlated terms, you can add them to the query, or you can suggest to the user, would you like to add them to the query? Another use, really, as we'll see, is once there are perfectly correlated, you can remove one of them. Because if two words are perfectly correlated, then you're unnecessarily increasing the dimensionality. You see what I'm saying? So in fact, when you do correlation analysis, you can use that itself as a way of reducing dimensionality. You know, to the extent two words are very close, you know, act as if there's only one of those words, and wherever the other word appears, just substitute this word. So it reduces your vocabulary. It reduces the dimensionality of the vector, which is kind of nice. Okay, but we won't do that right now. That basically is also possible. Now, one first principles point to realize is that correlation is slippery than you might have thought. Okay, two words. If every time term T1 is appearing, term T2 is not appearing, are they correlated or not? They're correlated. They're actually negatively correlated. It's perfect negative correlation. So if you have T1, T2 won't be there. Okay. So if terms are not correlated, then you will see them appearing together in some document. Okay. In particular, think of the following scenario. Suppose N1 and N2 are the number of documents in the entire corpus that contain terms T1 and T2 respectively. Okay, then the probability that a random document contains term T1 is N1 by N. And the probability that the random document contains term T2 would be N2 by N. Okay, now the question is, what's the probability that a random document contains both T1 and T2? That's exactly where you start talking about correlation. If you think they are independent, then the new probability should be multiplication. That's it. If it's not equal to the multiplication of the two probabilities, then it's not independent. Do you see that? Okay. So basically, if they are independent, then the new probability would be N1 by N times N2 by N, which means the fraction of documents which contain both the terms in the corpus should be N times N1 by N times N2 by N. Right? Which would be, let's say, M documents. N1 by N times N2 by N. Now, suppose you looked into the entire corpus and counted the number of documents which actually contain both the keywords. Let's say that's M. You will say that the two terms are independent only if this number is approximately equal to this number. Okay? If it is much less or much more than M, then they are not independent. Okay? So for example, it would be, if this number, so in fact, if the real number of documents in which they appear together is much less than this, then that means they are negatively correlated. If it is much more than this, then that means they are positively correlated. But either of them means they are correlated. Okay? So it's kind of what, again, this is a very first principles idea, but some people sometimes get confused. So you have to notice that independence doesn't mean there won't be any overlap of documents where both terms appear. You know, so correlation means that there is either more or less overlap than could be accounted for by just independence. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's exactly the point to understand there. Okay. So again, if they are correlated, this number is either much less or, in fact, much greater. Okay. So now, in some sense, you are trying to compute these correlations. Okay. One idea. So now, the way we will do this, there are many, many, many ways of doing this. One easy idea is to first start realizing that from here onwards, we will start thinking of these document term matrices. Okay. When I say DT, it's a document term matrix, and TD it would be term document matrix. Okay, in this particular case, these are the terms, these are the documents. Okay, and so in this document, interface is appearing 0 times, human is appearing 1, etc., etc. Now you always knew that documents are vectors in the space of terms. But if you think of this as a matrix, going back to your linear algebra days, a matrix has both a row space and a column space, right? So just as you can think of documents as vectors in the space of terms, you can think of terms as vectors in the space of documents, right? And what we will do now is start talking about term-term correlation by looking at these vectors corresponding to the terms in terms of documents. Okay, so the first idea would be to just see, so if I give you, by the way, one other thing you have to remember is I get to write, normally I tend to write document term matrix. That means documents are the rows, terms are the columns. But that's not necessary. In this case, that's not the case. For example, in this case, terms are the rows, documents are the columns. All you need to know is it TD or DT? Okay. Now, if I give you DT, let's say, then if I multiply it by, I'm sorry, if I give you a DT, if I multiply DT transpose by DT, what do I get? In some sense, I'll get a matrix. It's a matrix multiplication. Okay, it's a matrix multiplication. DT transpose times DT will be TD times DT, which will be TT. Use this sort of thinking because it helps a lot. You won't ever get confused if you think in terms of, if you think of the document as M, you don't know what M transpose is. But if you think of the document as DT or TD, then the transpose would be TD or DT. And you can also think in terms of multiplication. This is a little trick that you can use to not ever get confused, because we'll keep multiplying these documents around as we go around. Okay? So if I want to do term-term correlation, I just do DT transpose times DT, which I'll get TT. Okay? And if I want to do document-document correlation, I get DD. And you know how to get either of them now. Okay? So there's no question of getting confused. Now, consider the TT matrix. Okay, if you are computing the TT matrix, and if you actually normalize such that each vector has zero mean, then the correlation, so then essentially the TT similarity matrix should be in such a, if in fact the terms are truly independent, if in fact the terms are truly independent, then it should be the case that a term is, you know, the way you define the correlation, it better be the case that a term is most correlated with itself and zero correlated with everybody else. That's what independent dimensions means. So if you computed the TT, then if in fact the original dimensions were orthogonal to each other, okay, then so in fact that's one of the interesting things. If you have an orthonormal matrix, ortho means each column in the matrix is perpendicular to every other column in the matrix. Normal means its overall all the vectors are magnitude 1, each column is magnitude 1. If you have an orthonormal matrix M, you multiply M by its transpose M dash, you get what? Identity matrix. That's the definition of orthonormal basis. Okay, from the linear algebra days. Okay, so if in fact these guys were truly independent, when you do this correlation analysis, you will get one from the diagonal. Everything else should be zero. To the extent you don't get zeros, that means they're correlated. And in fact, the numbers can tell you what is correlated more with what. That's exactly what we're trying to do now. Okay. And there are multiple ways of computing the correlations. The simplest thing is essentially to do term-term matrix, term document times document term. We'll get you term-term. Okay? Here is a, let's see, where is my, okay. Okay, so here is a simple example. I'll again look at another example a little later. This one is much simpler, so I'm going to show this to you first. So I have only three keywords, K1, K2, K3. Okay, and seven documents. Okay, D1 to D7. And here is how the documents have these keywords in them. Okay, so the simplest idea to compute the correlation matrix is just unnormalized raw correlation matrix, which would be, this is like TD matrix. So you take TD times TD dash, which will be TT. So this matrix times its transpose. And if you do that, matrix multiplication, you'll get this. Okay, and as it is, you sort of see that the diagonal numbers are bigger in this matrix, because every term better be most correlated with itself. Otherwise, we'll get into this Charlie-Chaplin problem. Okay, but what is tricky is that the numbers for different vectors, in each vector, the diagonal element, I'm sorry, in each row, the diagonal element is going to be the highest. For each term, it's going to be most similar to itself. But the rows themselves are sort of incompatible. They could be unnormalized. It could depend upon how much, you know, if there are some keywords which are more frequent than others, okay, then you may be essentially missing, you wouldn't be normalizing the correlation. So the usual thing that we do to normalize the correlation is to normalize this matrix in the following way. You consider ij element essentially is the unnormalized correlation between the term I and term j. And in the normalized matrix, the ijth element is defined as the ijth element in the unnormalized matrix divided by the iith plus jjth minus ijth element. Now, why is this? This is actually called a Pearson correlation coefficient. In essence, what it does is it tries to normalize for differing frequencies of certain terms. Okay, all you need to really know is which terms are correlated with each other, not which terms are more frequent. Okay, and so what you're doing in this case is S12, the capital S12 is small S12 divided by S11 plus S22 minus S12. And this does have the advantage that, in fact, if you're looking for S11, it would be S11 divided by S11 plus S11 minus S11, which will be what? 1. Which means the term is correlated to itself maximum 1. And everything else will be less than 1. Okay? So if you do that, this is the correlation matrix you get. This is the normalized correlation matrix. And this in some sense is easier to interpret, because in each row, this is basically the row corresponding to term 1. Term 1 is most similar to itself. Next most similar to the term 3, second most similar to term 2. And similarly, term 2 is most similar to itself, next most similar to term 3, and third most similar to the term 1. That's all. Okay? So given this particular kind of a keywords, given this particular kind of matrix, you essentially can ask, for example, if the user just gave keyword K1, you can ask what is the most closest other keywords. You can take M closest keywords and suggest to the user, would you like to add these on, for example. Okay. So in this particular case, if you are looking for K2, if K2 is the keyword that the user gave, you would say, would you like to add K3 to make the query more elaborate? Okay. Let's look at our database statistics example. Okay. So Remember this example, we'll use this many, many times. We used it last time too. So again, there are 10 documents. This time I changed. Documents are rows, terms are columns. But you better not get confused, because think of this as DT matrix. So if you want to do TT, what do? You take DT transpose times DT. That'll give you TT. Okay, there's no magic. Okay, so for this matrix, you know, you throw in this matrix and get the TT matrix in your, you do matrix multiplication, you get this matrix. Okay? And if you then do the Pearson correlation coefficient on this matrix, you'll get that matrix. Okay? I just did it before coming to the class. I used MATLAB. I started with this matrix, which is DT, and I multiplied DT transpose by DT. I got this, and then I wrote a little two-line program to get this. You can do that also. Okay? Now, what's interesting now is you know these keywords, so let's try to make sense of them. Here, this is the row corresponding to the first keyword, database. Database is most similar to itself, second most similar to SQL, and third most similar to index. Okay? So if the user says database, you can ask, would you like to throw in a database, an index, or a SQL? And it does sort of also work with your intuition given the way the documents are. Okay? And also notice that the keyword similarity for the other keywords is much less. The correlation with the other keywords is much less. Okay? That's as you expect. Okay. Let's do one other thing, which is, so notice the following thing. Database is highly correlated with SQL, but it seems to be less correlated with index. Consider the following scenario, where every document, a large fraction of documents that contain database, contain the word SQL. And also another large fraction of documents that contain the word SQL contain the word index. These may not be the exact same. You know, I have a million documents, okay? 200,000 of them have database and SQL together. Another 200,000 have SQL and index together. If there is no document where database and index are appearing together at all, let's say, in this corpus, I would still like to say that database is somehow transitively close to index, because database is a friend of SQL, SQL is a friend of index, so database must be sort of a friend of index. The original analysis we did doesn't capture that. Okay? And how do I capture that? Now, in this particular example, it turns out that database and index are already correlated to begin with. But if they were, you know, it could be that originally there is no single document where database and index are appearing together, or there are a total of 200,000 documents where database and index, there are a total of, let's say, 50,000 documents where database and index appear together, and another 150,000 where SQL and index appear together. In which case, you shouldn't just assume that database is weakly correlated with index. You should realize that, in fact, it's more than weakly correlated, because it's not just the 50,000 where they both appear together, but you also get some push because your friend SQL is appearing together with database, with index, right? You want to capture that. So normally, you want that's basically the transitive clustering idea. By the way, this idea, which we just until now we looked at, is called association clusters. Don't ask me why they call them clusters, but an idea is you can essentially look at this matrix, and for each keyword, you can get the cluster of k keywords that are closest to it. And in this case, you know, you get, you know, in this case, if the cluster size is 1, then you know for each keyword, the closest keyword will be given. And when cluster size is 2, that means for each keyword you get one extra keyword that's closest to it. Okay. Now the other issue is how to spread the influence between keywords. And here is a nice idea. Look at this thing. This is a vector corresponding to one term. Okay, so these vectors, you can also think of these as vectors, and these vectors are vectors in the space of terms, and so these are term vectors in the space of terms. Okay, if in fact the terms were completely independent of each other, it would have been made reasonable sense, because these vectors would be 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. It's exactly what you think it should be. Terms are vectors in the original space, except they have zero components and every other dimension except their own dimension. But now they are not independent, and so there is a leakage. They have some projections in some other terms. So let's start thinking about these as, this is a vector for term 1, this is a vector for term 2, this is a vector for term 3. Then I can say that the similarity between term I and term j is vector similarity between those two vectors, ith vector and the jth vector. And notice that the similarity between, when you do that, so for example, the number here would be, so this is term, this would be the similarity between the first vector and the second vector, because this is t1, 2. And this is a element 1, 2, so you take that first term's vector and take the similarity of it with the second term's vector. Now the way you compute similarity, use cosine theta metric. You know one, so you keep using it. The advantage now is, if it turns out that some components are zero but other components are high, you know, the kind of thing we talked about, database is either correlated highly with SQL or an SQL is highly correlated with index, when you take the vector space similarity, they wind up being more correlated with each other. So it spreads the influence around. Okay, there are two things to understand here. One is this notion of transitivity, you know, that you in fact want correlation to be computed in terms of transitivity too. And the second is the crazy way in which you try to look for using vector space similarity whenever you get a chance. You know, if you look at IR literature, you'll find that people are always keeping their eyes open to see, can we somehow use vector space similarity? You know, whatever the problem, try to use it. You know, here is another place where we are winding up using vector space similarity to compute term similarity instead of term, you know, document similarity. Okay, so what happens in this particular case? So all I'm doing is the new document's uvth element would be dot product divided by the norms, which is essentially cosine theta metric, where this would be the entire row corresponding to the uth term. This will be the entire row corresponding to the vth term. Okay. So if you do that in this particular case, so this was the unnormalized metric. This is normalized one. This is the transitively. This is the one where each term now corresponds. So this term now is the cosine theta metric between this vector and this vector. Okay? And notice that in fact this term actually has now become 0.226. It used to be 0.097, now it's become 0.226. Now in this case, it so happened that even after this analysis, if you ask what is the most correlated keyword to keyword 1, it's still keyword 3. Because, you know, it so happened, even though it increased this, it didn't increase beyond this. But it's quite possible that if you have many other keywords, some of the keywords which are transitively connected will get boosted, and the other keywords which are still not at all connected to the other terms will remain almost at the same level as they were before, and so you start seeing more connections between terms as you want to do. Okay? This idea is called scalar clustering. I don't know why it's called scalar clustering, but it's a very nice idea. Think of terms as vectors in the space of terms. Okay? Think of terms as vectors in the space of terms, which should make them completely orthogonal. But since we know that they are not independent, they won't be orthogonal, and so you can do vector space similarity. It's like we make a mistake and we start trying to exploit that mistake. You know, if you get what I mean. I mean, originally they were supposed to be independent. They are not independent, but we start exploiting whatever mileage we can get out of the fact that they are not independent. Okay. Now, on the database thing, right? So this one was for the association clusters. And if you do the Scalar clusters, in the Scalar clusters, you'd get those numbers. And all you see here is that one of the important things is, again, the order didn't change, but they became much closer to each other. In fact, this one, this is index, right? Index is now much closer to database than it was previously, because there is more of an influence because index appearing together with SQL than from the influence of just index appearing together with database. Okay? This is an easy idea, and you should be able to implement this. You know, it's not that hard to understand what's going on here. Okay, yes?
Just to repeat, this 0.9604, it's a cosine product between T1 and T2.
So this one would be what is T1-2th element. No, take any random one. Okay, this is a 1-2th element. 1-2th element will be the first row cosine theta metric with the second row. That's it. Cosine theta metric. So it's basically, I took this entire vector, dot this entire vector, divided by the norm of this vector, and also divided by the norm of this vector. Yes?
The calculation,
when
you consider the first order or the database?
Yes.
So it's not like
iterative. I agree. That's true. Yes. So to some extent, it spreads a little bit more. But ultimately, you're not spreading it. So if it is the case, so you can ask. In fact, it's not that hard to set up scenarios. Set up documents, you know, I did not set it up here, but you can play with a set of documents where, you know, a bunch of database documents have the SQL in it, and a bunch of SQL documents have the index in it, a bunch of index documents have some other word in it, and see whether or not zeros start becoming non-zeros. Do you understand what I'm saying? And let me suggest to you guys that, you know, before I start actually forcing you to do it, play with MATLAB. It's pretty nice. So that was the DT matrix that you had. Okay, so you can play with this and DT transpose times, sorry, that's just DT transpose times, that will be TD times DT. That's the numbers. I'm sorry, wait. Yeah, this is columns 1 through 6, so it only showed pieces at a time because I put larger amount of, so basically these and those next to it, okay? And then you can do, you know, various pieces of code to compute, I just learned this myself, so it, you know, you guys are much better than me. It's a bad program, but I just want to show you how. Where is it? Okay, there. That's the piece of code that I had to put together to compute the ijth element in the scalar clustering. So all I'm saying is go from I equal to 1 to 6, j equal to 1 to 6, and the ijth element is the row correspond to the ith element times the scalar product of that with the row corresponding to the jth element. To get the scalar product, you take the transpose and divide it by the norms of both the vectors. That's all I have to do. Okay, it's fun to play with that because you can get some of these questions answered as to whether higher order, things are captured. Okay. Now there are variations of this on this theme. Lots and lots of variations on this theme. I want to at least mention one of them, which is right now the way we are considering it. We are saying whether a term appears together with another term in the document, that's all. But it could well be that the document is 10,000 words long and the term T1 is appearing in the first word, term T2 consistently appears in the end of the document or somewhere very far away. So co-occurring should also consider, it's not that the document is a little thing, a document can be very large, and if they are very far away from each other, you should not consider them to be really co-occurring. Okay, so you can do this entire analysis with respect to distances. Okay, where ij, so r of ti tj can be taken as the minimum distance in terms of the number of separating words between ti and tj in any single document. And you can, for example, use that as the basis matrix and do everything else that I did to you. You see what I'm saying? So it just improved the notion of whether or not they're appearing together. And then if you do that, you will start getting the, you know, simple cluster matrix, and you can start doing scalar clustering on top of that by doing vector similarity for individual rows. Okay? So I just want to mention that you could potentially use these kinds of ideas to capture, better capture the notion of real co-occurrence. You know, because they're not only occurring together, but they're occurring together closely, not far away from each other. Okay. So that is nice. We did correlation analysis. But I want us to think about this issue that I was talking about last time, and I just put it all together in one slide. So suppose I started with documents described in terms of just keywords U and V. Okay? But then I added a bunch of new keywords of the form 2U minus 3V, 4U minus V, etc. And I gave the new document term matrix to you. You would be a large number of terms in this document. So the vectors, the document vectors will be high dimensional because, you know, as many terms as I added is increasing the number of dimensions. But I'm telling you that I actually started with, I mean, this, let's say you have oracular information that this is what I was doing, okay? So you know really that the documents are really vectors in the original space of two dimensions, U and V. But then I made them artificially larger dimensions. Could you have figured this out? Okay, question one. Because if you can figure this out, you can reduce the dimensionality of the vectors, and it makes a lot of sense because we saw the dimensionality of the vectors. Higher the dimensionality, you know, the less of a semantics similarity between vectors have. Okay? Second question. Suppose in the same thing above, I want it to be a little more mean. I not only did this, but I also added a bit of noise. So it's not exactly the case that the new terms are directly linear combinations of the old terms. It's linear combinations of the old terms plus a little noise, just to get you off the scent. Could you have still figured out, you know, so two important issues. One is, if this is the case, A, you should at least feel that I should be motivated to find some technique which will allow me to find the real dimensionality of the data. Even though there are multiple dimensions, there really should be two, and I should be able to find them. Okay? And here I'm saying I am also having noise. So you cannot prove that completely that, if, you know, other elements are exact linear combinations of previous elements. But they're close enough because I added, let's say, in particular, let's say I added zero mean Gaussian noise. So if you add zero mean Gaussian noise numbers, they all add up to zero with high expectation. Okay? It would be nice to be able to figure out in that case too that the original data is really two-dimensional. Okay? Can you do that? And, you know, you should be interested in doing it. The third one is, suppose further that I remove the original keywords. I don't even have UV as part of the thing anymore. I only have 2U plus 3V plus some random noise, and 7U plus, you know, 15V plus some random noise, etc., etc. So the original dimensions are gone. So no subset of the dimensions I gave you are the correct dimensions. You know, in this, in the case here and here, if you, all you needed to find is the correct subset. Let's say there were k dimensions, two of them are the right ones. So if you consider k dimensions, there are 2 power k subsets of dimensions, and you want to find the smallest subset, that's enough. You understand what I'm saying? And you had a hope of doing that, you know, just 2 power n dimensions and, you know, pick out 2 power n subsets, and one of them would be the right one. But by here, you don't even have that hope. In fact, the original dimensions have gone. The only things that are left are really the linear combinations of the original dimensions. Can you then find out what must have been the original dimensions? You're reconstructing what, you know, I did something to get you off my scent, and you have to reconstruct and find the true dimensionality of the data. Can you find this? Now, what's more interesting is that if you did find the new dimensions, UV, notice that in the new space, UV, the terms of all the documents here would themselves be vectors in that new space. They would be non-trivial vectors. Because U and V are no longer present in the original dimensions, right? So if you reconstruct U and V, then, and make them the basis of the dimensional space, then every other keyword that you have are things like 2U minus 3V, 4U plus 5V, and they would all be vectors in the UV space. So your original, your terms that you started with could well be vectors in this space of true terms. Now in that same space of true terms, the document also would be vectors. So we did crazy stuff. We started talking about documents as vectors in the space of terms. We then talked about terms as vectors in the space of documents. Now I'm saying both of them can be vectors in a third space. Think of them as the real basis. Call them factors. Okay? So you want to find the inherent factors for this data. And find the factor space, and everything will be documents, everything will be vectors in that space. Okay? Now, it's reasonable to do. Given that I could be doing this kind of a thing, you want to be able to see whether you can get back. Okay? Now, why would I be worrying? Why should I be so paranoid? Why are people out to get me? The reality is that the people are out to get you. You just didn't realize it. I just made it explicit to you. Okay? So the idea, the fact that the keywords in the documents are not actually independent and that they have synonymy, that means they are close to each other, or that they have polysemy, that means they have multiple different meanings, okay, among them, often manifests itself as if some malevolent oracle has mixed up the original data in the clean space to be that last one that I showed you. So the idea is there was some real data untouched by any noise and any correlation, anything, and you did some linear combinations of keywords, okay? And then you added some noise, then you omitted some of the keywords now. And if you're unlucky, you would start omitting the original keywords. And when you come out, that's exactly what I showed you. Right? And it happens. That's basically one way of thinking about what's happening in the real world. So the question, of course, is, can I invert this process and find these dimensions? And you should be able to understand that finding those dimensions is worth your time. Is indeed worth your time. Okay? Now, there is a fourth one, which I did not show previously. It turns out the answer for all this is yes. In fact, this is bigger than this, and this is bigger than this, right? The last case is like the most general case. And if you can solve this, then you can solve the other two. And the answer basically turns out to be principal components analysis or latent, and which when applied in the context of information retrieval has been called latent semantic indexing. It looks like a huge big word, but really what you're doing are doing eigenvectors for matrices, modulo something. Okay? So that's good. But it would work if I also started saying things like 2u square minus 4u cube. If I did that, then latent semantic indexing won't work. As long as the malevolent oracle is only really not so malevolent, it only is sort of doing linear combinations, you can get by. If it's doing nonlinear combinations, you won't be able to get by. Okay. Okay. Fish. You have fish. you have a bunch of fish. Change the topic. And here are a bunch of fish. There's a big fish, a small fish, a medium fish, etc., etc. And I've decided to look at the fish in terms of two dimensions, the length and the width. Okay? And I looked at a bunch of fish, and I have looked at for each fish. Remember that I didn't say bunch of fishes, because there is no fishes, it's all fish. And for each fish, there is a vector point corresponding to the length and breadth of the fish. Okay? So, I made a nice plot of fish. Okay? This is presumably length, and this is presumably width, or vice versa. And a point in this space corresponds to one other fish. This is what I got. This is my plot right now. The question is the following. Do I really need to know both length and height? Can I just get by with just one term? No, you cannot get by with one term, because if you only take length, that don't work. If you only take height, it doesn't work. But what if I define a new dimension called length plus, I mean, I'm calling it height, but height can be width. Okay. So what if I define a new dimension called length plus width? I call it size. I argue that size completely distinguishes these fish in terms of, you know, ultimately what you really want to know is it a big fish or a small fish? You know, if you're an angler and you're trying to say, I've caught a big fish, right? All you really need to say is either it's really long or it's kind of short but really wide. Both ways you get to tell your friend, man, I got a big fish. Okay? Really what you're interested in, the size of it. And so the question is, can I figure this out automatically? Can I figure out that size is what matters? And size in this, I mean, I made up a name called size. It's a different dimension. It's a linear combination of length and height. Okay? Now, first understand that this is not that different from what I was just telling you about documents. Originally, the fish god created fishes with respect to one keyword called, one attribute called size, which then got split into two extra attributes, height and width, which are sort of linear combinations of size. Okay? And then some of the original size got thrown out of the window. So you're only having this other dimension. And so you want to actually capture the original dimension. Can I do that? One way of thinking about this problem is, if you look at this space of this vector, what are the axes along which there is most diversity, most variation of data? Most variation of data. Okay? Is that this axis? Not really. Is it this axis? No, because both of them have about the same variation. What if I told you, you can push the axis around? You can make linear, you know, rotations and transformation of the axis. What would you where would you have put the x and y axis and the origin such that you would get the maximum variation of the data in one of the axes, next maximum variation of the data in the next axis, third maximum variation of the data in the third axis, and so on. In this case, it's very obvious. I would put one axis like this, one axis like this. And in this, this axis captures maximum variation. If I should go with just one, I would go with this axis. If I'm allowed to go with two axes, I will take this as well as this. In this case, there are only two axes, so if you take two, you take all the axes. But if it's an n-dimensional data, you still might have axis 1, axis 2, axis 3, which are ordered in the order of most variation, second most variation, third most variation. If you have that, then you know which ones to get rid of. It's not hard to get rid of keywords. If only somebody told you, this is the keyword that seems to disperse the data the most, this is the next most dispersing keyword, this is the next most dispersing keyword. And the problem is complicated by the fact that A, nobody told you which is the most keyword with the most variation, and secondly, there may not be such a keyword. In fact, the keyword with respect to the maximum variation might be a linear combination of the existing keywords. And you could find this here. At least in the picture, you could find it. Okay? The question is there something that we know that could have given you this information? Yes. And that's more or less where we land today, to say that something that you very well know, which is essentially eigenvector computation, eigenvalue computation of matrices, would capture this. So for example, think of what you're doing here. What you tried here in these two dimensions is to fit the best ellipsoid to the data. And once you fit the best ellipsoid, then the axis of the ellipsoid, this is the major axis of the ellipsoid, this is the minor axis. If it's an n-dimensional ellipsoid, then there'll be a first major axis, second major axis, and so on. And furthermore, for each axis, the lambdas, the eigenvalues, will give you the amount of variation expected in that axis. This is what actually eigenvector computations are doing for you. Okay? So, in fact, this data, if you do the eigenvalue computation, you would get two eigenvalues. This one is 1.75, this is 0.25. And you also get eigenvectors. When you do eigen decomposition, remember you get vectors as well as values, right? The eigenvectors are telling you what are the two unit vectors for the new coordinate space for this data. And for each vector, there is an eigenvalue corresponding to that. The higher eigenvalue tells you that that's the axis with the most variation. The next highest, that's the one with the next most variation, and so on. In particular, if I get to just take one axis, then I will get 1.75 divided by 1.75 plus 0.25, which is 1.75 by 2, which is 87.5% of the variation in the data can be captured just by asking one axis. Okay? And this is what eigenvector computation does. And when we come back next class, we ask the obvious question, if you can do it for fish, why not do this for documents? Okay? And we'll answer that. That's basically related to singular value decomposition.